Hello, nice to see you all. For those of you who have been trying to take pictures to get pictures of Davis, you should know that Ajahn Brahm, what does Brahm mean? Brahm is from Brahma, one of the Davis. To take a picture of me, you got a Davis straight away. Hi, Venerable. Welcome. Okay, so this evening's Dhamma talk, we're going to be talking about the end of the journey, enlightenment. Still a few people haven't finished their journey into the hall yet, so we better wait for a few moments. And this is the last Dhamma talk this session. Maybe I should mention that the people from the BGF, the Buddhist Gem Fellowship, which have invited me before, have agreed to have a couple of talks in the end of January. That's next month. So there's some more talks coming. So don't worry if you're not enlightened yet. You've got many more chances. And it gives me a month to think of some new stories and new jokes for you. Okay, so today's Dhamma talk is on the end of the journey, enlightenment. And of course, for all of those of you who've been on this Dhamma retreat, it is a journey, and you're coming close to the end of the journey yet, but hopefully it really is the end of a journey and not just the start of another one. Because sometimes it's, when we look at our life, when we get one thing finished, another thing starts, and life seems endless. But the Buddha said, yes, it is an end of this life, there is an end of the universe, but that's to be found in this fathom-long body with its mind. In other words, when one practices meditation, one can come to the end of things. And like any journey, if it didn't have an end to it, the journey would be hopeless. So there is an end to your journey, and that's called Nibbana, enlightenment. But sometimes as practitioners, we need to actually understand exactly what that word means. I mentioned yesterday sort of my own spiritual journeys, in the sense that when I was young, I was supposed to be a Christian, but I asked people what God meant, and I could never get a straight idea, a straight answer what God meant. And it's the same thing with enlightenment. I could never get a straight answer what enlightenment meant. You go in to ask even monks, and they say, he who says doesn't know. He who knows doesn't say. And I thought, what a great line. Until I figured out, if he said that, whoever says doesn't know. If he said that, he obviously didn't know. So the point is, it's easy to be clever about these things. But I really wanted to find out someone who knew what they were talking about. And it's always been an understanding which I've had. If a person can't explain it clearly, most of the time they don't know what they're talking about. They're just making it up. Or they're just trying to grab onto some little concept, strange idea, which because it's mystical, in other words, because no one can understand it, some people think, oh, it must be the truth. Because too often there is that sort of mysticism, that mysteriousism, and people actually say these amazing things, say, wow, that's really good, because you don't understand it. But remember that if you can't understand it, the chances are neither can the person who's just told you that. And it was something which I read a long time ago when I was a student. I forget the actual philosopher, but the philosopher said that if there's any truth, if a child can't understand it, it's not real truth. So I wanted actually to find out an understanding of enlightenment. First of all, if we're going to talk about enlightenment, what actually enlightenment is, so you can understand exactly what you're doing, and you can also check out other people to see if they understand what they're doing. In all the years which I've been teaching and listening to stories, the story which best encompasses what enlightenment is, in a way which ordinary people can understand, even children can understand, is a story about the ending of desire. I think many of you would have probably heard from the monks, read from the texts, that what enlightenment is the ending of greed, hatred and delusion. What does that actually mean in practice? And how could a child understand that? Remember, this is the end of the journey. Because sometimes when I talk about contentment, letting go, end of desire, people in the world, they're saying, I've got a job to do. I've got people working for me. I can't give up desire yet. And yet what you're saying is correct. This is the end of the journey, not the middle. This is actually where you're going to end up at, not where you are now. So understanding that, please don't get afraid. I'm not going to ask you to all become monks and nuns after this talk. Carry on working. Be good. Keep your precepts. Be as peaceful and as compassionate and hardworking as you possibly can. But as you practice the Dhamma, I'm going to tell you where it leads. Eventually there will come the time when you retire, you leave the world, either early on in life or later on in life. And you can't be working all your life. You do your job, you do your duties as best you can. There'll come a time when you give up your job, your children are grown up, and you want to spend more time developing your mind and going closer to the Buddha's teaching of enlightenment. Because you know the Buddha left the world, and the great monks and nuns who became enlightened lived a very peaceful life. And maybe if you can't even become a monk, at least the end years of your life, if you have good health, you can actually leave your job, retire, and practice Dhamma. So these are for those people at the end of their life, what actually Nirvana is. And the story is one of my favorite ones, but it's incredibly profound. I'll just tell you the ordinary story first, and then you can contemplate it, or I can explain it afterwards. It's the story of the wishing game, the five children playing the wishing game. I haven't told this in the book Opening the Door of Your Heart, because it's going to be in another book which I'm writing, or which I've written, it's just being edited now in the US. But the story of the wishing game is the best story, which really gets to the heart of what enlightenment is, in a practical way which you can really understand. The story of the wishing game goes like this. There are five children playing a wishing game. The rules of the game is you have a wish, and whichever child gets the best wish wins the wishing game. So the first child was asked, if you had a wish, what would it be? And being only a child, he said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a McDonald's hamburger with double fries. Because he liked McDonald's hamburgers. Very good, the other children said. Now they asked child number two, if you had a wish, what would it be? Perhaps because he had more chance to think, he said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for a McDonald's hamburger restaurant. Because with a restaurant, I can get many hamburgers. Not just one. And if I owned a restaurant, my mother could never stop me getting one. And of course, a child who only got one hamburger thought, I've lost. That guy is smarter than me. And they asked the third child, if you had a wish, what would your wish be? Straight away, the child said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for $1 billion. US, of course. Because with $1 billion US, I can buy my own McDonald's restaurant. I can have as many hamburgers as he has. But I will also buy my own video game store. So I can play video games. Then I'll buy my own school. If I buy my own school, I won't have to go and still get the best grades. I might even be able to buy my own university later on and award myself a degree. And I'd still have many millions of dollars left to get whatever I want whenever I think about it. Because it takes a lot to spend $1 billion US in one lifetime. And so the guy who only got one hamburger restaurant thought, oh, how stupid I am. If only I would have thought of that. That guy with the $1 billion wish is sure to win the wishing game. But there's two more children left yet. If you haven't heard this before, what would your wish be? The fourth child said, if I had a wish, I'd wish for three wishes. That's a wish, he said. Fair enough. It doesn't break the rules. With my first wish, I'll have a hamburger restaurant, McDonald's. With my second wish, I'll have the $1 billion US. And for my third wish, I'll have three more wishes. So that way I can go on forever. Beat that. And the first three children thought this poor child was a genius. He's sure to win the wishing game. It was an infinity of wishes. What people in the world would dream about. Whatever you want, you'll get. Whenever you want it. Surely that's the ultimate happiness. Surely that must win the wishing game. But there was one child left. The next child formulated a wish which would win the wishing game. He said, "If I had a wish, I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes again. I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes again." That child wins the wishing game. That child is the Buddha. Do you understand that story? When you think about it, having as many wishes given to you, it always means if you have another wish, you're not really happy. You always want something more. However, in a wishing game, the last child understood, "I'm so content, I don't need any more wishes." That is superior. We call that the freedom from desires. The fourth child, who had an infinity of wishes, his idea of happiness is called the freedom of desires. Now you see, in our world, most of our aim, most of our striving, is to actually get the freedom of desires. So that whenever we want something, we can always get it. To have enough money, to have enough power, to have enough means. If we want to go to New York, Perth, wherever, we can always go there. If we want to buy a house, buy a car, buy some clothes, if we want to give some money to our kids, whatever it is, we have what we want. In other words, we're striving for a freedom of desires. And if you look in modern Western countries, their constitutions, their whole ethos is to try and give their citizens just that, to give them the maximum freedom to realize their desires. And that is why in Western countries, like the US, you have this idea of freedom. But what that freedom is just the freedom of desires. To get whatever you want, whenever you want it, for some people. The American dream. But the American dream is not the Buddhist dream. Which is why if any of you have ever been to that country, or been in the West, you find that many people, especially rich people, never feel free. Even though they have huge amounts of money, even though they have great abilities to come and go in their private jets to have whatever they want, they never feel free. Why? Because they do have the freedom of desires, but they don't know the freedom from desires. There's another little story which emphasizes this. Again, a story from my life. I think I told this in Singapore, not here, but if I have told it here, please interrupt me. Sometimes being a monk, you give so many talks, so many questions, I don't know what I've said and what I haven't said, so please forgive me. It was a story when I was a young monk. I'd helped someone because they needed some help and I'd served them, and then they came up afterwards, they say they wanted to give me some money. I said, "I'm a monk who doesn't receive any money." But they were smart. There is actually a way around this. What you can do is actually you can say, "Ajahn Brahm, you really helped me. I want to get something for you personal, not for your monastery, not for your retreat center. For you. What can I get you," he said, "for 100 baht. It was in Thailand. So he actually named the amount, so I knew exactly just what he was talking about. And he said, "Let me know, what can I get you for 100 baht? You can actually do that. You can come up to me and say, "Ajahn Brahm, for 50 ringgit, what can I get for you? Anything personal, anything you need. But please don't do that to me. It was done to me so many years ago." He came up and said, "You really helped me, I've got 100 baht for you, what can I get for you?" Because they can't give you the money, but they can give you the goods. I was so happy before he said that. I was so at peace, I was a very happy little monk. But as soon as he said that, I started thinking, what do I want? And I couldn't actually think of it at the time, and he was in a rush. So we came to agreement. He said, look, I'm coming back tomorrow. If you can't think about it now, just go back to your hut, think about it there, write it down, and I'll come in the morning. So I went back to my hut, I got out a piece of paper, what do I want for 100 baht? And I started thinking. And I wrote something down, and I wrote something else down. In 5 minutes, 100 baht was not enough. When I looked at all those things, I just couldn't bring myself to cross anything out. And more than that, every time I started thinking, I started adding more things on. In about 10 minutes, 1,000 baht was not enough. If I'd have carried on, 1 million baht would not be enough. And as soon as I wrote those things down, every one of those things was really important to me. And I saw what was going on. My sort of so-called wants had turned to craving and turned to real grasping. And I screwed that piece of paper up, I threw it in the bin. And next morning when he came, I said, don't give me anything, put that 100 baht in the donation box for the monastery and don't do that to me ever again. He just showed me just what craving is and what desire is. What is the difference between needs and wants is a very fine line. And actually most of the time, because of delusion, all of our needs becomes wants. And we never have enough. One of the reasons I became a monk was because when I was very young, I started to look at life and see what I was doing. Sometimes it was crazy what I was doing, what other people were doing in their life. It was like this, that when I was very young, I used to love playing soccer with my friends in the park, which is, you know, just on the opposite side of the road to where my parents lived. However, when I got to about 14, my parents and my teachers took me aside and said, listen, stop wasting your time chasing a football. Stay at home. Do your homework. Study more. Because you're doing your O-levels this year. I did my O-levels a bit earlier. Because if you do, you know the O-level examinations. You know, you have them here in Malaysia as well. Because if you pass your O-levels and do well, they told me, then you'll be happy. And I believe them. So I stopped going with my friends to the park, and I instead stayed at home, studied, and I did very well at my O-levels. However, the promised happiness never came. Because I did well at my O-levels, I had to stay on at school doing A-levels now. But, they said, about this time my father died, my mother and my teachers, the rest of my family said, look, you've done well, keep on studying. At that time, I wasn't chasing footballs, I was chasing girls. They say, stay at home. Do your studies, because if you pass your A-levels, then you'll be happy. So I did that, and I did very well at my A-levels. So I had to go to Cambridge. More exams, more studies. So I still wasn't happy. But, they said, now, at university, if you pass your exams at university, if you study hard, don't go to the parties, don't stay in the bar. Stay in your room, study, work hard, pass your exams. Because if you get your degree, then you'll be happy. And of course, by this time, this was a time, as I wrote in the little book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, this was a time I started to get suspicious. Because I started looking at my friends, the people who'd finished university. Were they happy once they got their degree? All of those of you who've gone to university, are you happy when you finished and got your degree? You've got to go to work now. And that's really hard. And when you go to work, people say, well, what are you going to work for? To save up, to get enough money, and then you'll be happy. And I saw some of my friends, they were saving up for their first car. And they were telling me, they were getting these magazines, looking at the car they were going to buy, saying, oh, I need another few $100s, because when I buy my car, then I'll be happy. Yeah? Because what happened next? They were all going out with, you know, the girls were going out with boys, the boys going out with girls. And the boys, they will say that when I meet my soulmate, the person who's meant for me in heaven. When I meet them, I know. When I meet them, I know they're out there somewhere. When I meet them, they said, then I'll be happy. And of course, I didn't need to look, and you know this. Yeah, when you meet your soulmate and then you're happy, that's when the suffering really starts. So you say, when I get married, then I'll be happy. By the time you get married, what do you need when you get married? You need a new house or a big apartment. As a bachelor or just a single girl, you can live together with your friends or live with your family. But now you need a house, and apartments and houses are so expensive. So I saw some of my young friends who had just been married. They had to get a second job. They were working just so long, thinking, when we get enough to buy a house, then we'll be happy. By the time they got a house, they had children. And they started thinking, oh my goodness, when my children leave home, then I'll be happy. Because 18, 20, 25 years of hard work looking after your kids. And that's, I saw older people, some friends of my father, that's what they were saying. They were sort of planning for their retirement. When my children leave home, then we're free. We can go here, we can go there, we can go to the temple, we can go overseas. When my children leave home, then I'll be happy. But that, by that time, when your children actually finally do leave home, are you happy? No. Because then you're getting so old, you're planning for your retirement. You're saving up money thinking, when I retire, then I'll be happy. And when you do retire, you've all seen most of the people who go to temples or churches are the old people. I've seen that. Maybe not some meditation retreats, but they go and do the chanting. You go to like a Mahayana temple when they're doing the chanting. They go to the churches in their services. Most of the people who go to these places are old people. You know why? Because they think, if I go to the church or the temple, that when I die, then I'll be happy. And that's our life. For most of us, we think, when we get the nimitta, then I'll be happy. When I get jhana, then I'll be happy. When I get enlightened, listen, that is not happiness. But isn't that your life? When I get this out of the way, then I'll be happy. That's called the freedom of desires. You have desire after desire after desire, never knowing enough. How much do you need to have enough? I know I get into trouble saying things like this, especially in highly motivated places like KL. All of you children studying so hard for your exams, if ever you fail an exam, dance for joy. Because once you've failed an exam, you don't have to do it anymore. If you keep on passing them, there's always another one next year. It's freedom at last. Now, what I'm saying there is you can see that desire never knows how many qualifications do you need? How many things do you need? How many possessions do you need? How many places do you have to go and see before you can become happy? Do you can see how our world runs on this endless desire? Now, that's called the opposite of nibbana. That's called the freedom of desires. And so many people think that's the end of life. To get so much money to win some lottery so you can retire. You've got all this money. Now I'm free. Have a look in the newspapers and the magazines of people who win the lottery. Are they happy? I saw just before I came here, actually was in the airport in Perth, there was an article about the man in the United States who won the biggest lottery so far in history. It was something like $300 million. By the time the tax office took their cut, I think he was left with $111 million. The tax office took a big share, but who cares? $111 million, that should satisfy you, shouldn't it? However, I think that in this article, he'd just been arrested for drunk driving. He was lonely, depressed, without friends, a complete mess. But they showed a picture of him before he won the lottery. He was a very happy young man, or middle-aged man. The win had ruined his life. And it's happened to many people which I've seen. So, is that the means of life? Is that the end of life? So when you understand that simile of the wishing game, instead of having the freedom of desires, the wealth and the power, there's another happiness which is even more important, which is the freedom from desires. To be so content, you never need any more wishes. Now, that degree of contentment is a simile for Nibbana, the end of desire. Sometimes people say, if everyone was enlightened, what would happen to the world? There'd be no one doing anything. There'd be no progress. There'd be no doing anything. Yeah, but this is only for those people who've had enough of the world, who now want to retire. There'd be plenty of other people craving and looking after these things and making big messes. Which is why sometimes, even like as monks, sometimes people look at us monks and say, what are you doing for the world? Just sitting there, you know, eating the alms food of other people. And I said, I am helping out with one of the biggest ecological problems of the world. Overpopulation. I am doing my part. It is one of the big problems. Too many people around. We need more monks and nuns. So the point is, anyway, enlightenment is the end of desire. And it's not a dull state. So content, so happy you don't need anything more. Can you imagine what that's like? And the point of the Buddha, the point of the Arahats, the enlightened beings, is you can see you don't need that much to have an end of desire. You don't need the world to be content. Just a few things is enough for ultimate contentment. So enlightenment is contentment, the end of greed, hatred and delusion. If you understand that that is the end, how can that come about? How can one lessen this craving, this desire which always wants things? Obviously the first thing one can do is to realize just the suffering inherent in wanting. Whenever you want something, at that moment you're separated from the object of your desire. If you get it, you may be happy for a while. If you don't get it, you suffer. That's why Oscar Wilde made this very wonderful statement. He said there's only two tragedies in life. Only two causes of suffering. He didn't know anything about Buddhism, but what he said was just so deep. The only two tragedies in life are this. The first tragedy is not getting what you want. The second tragedy is getting what you want. You understand that? When you want something, you can fantasize and dream that once I get that, then I'll be happy. But when you get it, you find it's not quite what you want. You may fantasize about that beautiful girl. Once I go out with her and get married, then I'll be happy. But once all the makeup comes off. Once actually see what it really is like. Because remember, when they're going out with you, they're trying to put on a face, they're trying to cover up all their faults, men and women. It's called marketing. You never get the real product. But sometimes when we get it, then we think, we're disappointed and we think we need something else afterwards. Desires are always unfaithful. In other words, when you get that desire, it promises you happiness and peace. But when you actually get it, it doesn't give you happiness and peace. It only gives rise to another wanting as well. So, understanding that, we understand that there is a problem. The problem of life is not solved by fulfilling your desires. You can try that path if you wish. Work hard, become wealthy, become rich, ask if you're happy. As a monk, I'm in a very privileged position. Sometimes you see very poor people, sometimes you see very wealthy people. see all types of people in my life as a monk. But on this one occasion, I was doing a house blessing for a very wealthy woman in Thailand, in Australia, in Perth. She just bought this wonderful mansion next to the river. I don't know how many millions it cost. And she wanted it blessed. So I went in there with a few other monks to do a traditional blessing ceremony for her house. When I got in the house, you couldn't believe how much marble there was there and how much expensive furnishings and stuff like that. When I sat down, they gave me a cup of tea first of all, but before we did the chanting, I asked to go to the toilet. This is no exaggeration. She had to draw me a map to get to the toilet. That was a huge house. And sometimes, at part of the blessing ceremony as a monk, we get this holy water, we sprinkle it in every room. It's a great way to have a look and see how many rooms there are, what goes on in there. It took a huge amount of time to go into every room and bless it. I don't know how many bedrooms were in that mansion, how many rooms. But I found out when I left, she lived in that house alone. She had no partner, no friends, no family at all. And I've come across that many times. Very wealthy people often have no friends. You know why? Because they're so afraid their friends will be asking for donation. It's true. All their relations, can you please lend me some money? They're so afraid. They live alone. This is the suffering of a person who's rich. So when I seen that, I saw that as a young student, because there was sometimes you saw these earls and very wealthy people at universities like Cambridge, and they weren't happy. So I realized that that's not the way to nirvana, just getting wealthy. Just having all those desires doesn't help at all. There must be some other way. And of course, when you went to, like I went to Thailand and saw these great monks, I couldn't believe it. These fellows were happy. They were at peace. They didn't want anything. And that showed me that there was another happiness called the freedom from desires. And you saw that actualized. These were people who didn't have desires. And that was very impressive. You could see their happiness. They were free. They had everything they ever wanted. In fact, you might say they wanted for nothing. Understand that term? To want for nothing. It's usually a term you ascribe to a person who's so fabulously wealthy, they can get whatever they want. But Ajahn Chah and those sorts of monks wanted for nothing because they didn't want anything. They wanted for nothing. To see the other way, to want for nothing, to want nothing, no wanting. And once I had a privilege, a moment I would never forget, when I actually went up to my teacher's room. Usually, his hut in this monastery was just on the upper level, and he'd receive guests on the open area underneath. And we usually spend all day receiving guests. And I was being a monk maybe 7 or 8 years, and perhaps this is why he trusted me, that while I was looking after him, he was receiving guests, he asked me to go up to his room to get something. It was wonderful. It's a time to go into the Holy of Holies to see my teacher's room. Now, by this time, Ajahn Chah was a very famous monk. He had the king, royalty, coming to see him. He had the great generals, incredibly wealthy people, just falling over themselves to give him things. When I went up into his room, I was so impressed. In his room, there was a straw mat like you're sitting on, just long enough for him to rest on. There was no pillow. There was one robe on the line, and that was it. He had no possessions. That was his room, where he lived. It was so incredibly empty. If he had to pack up and go to another monastery, it would take him 1 minute. If you have to pack to leave this retreat center, <laughs> Now you know the difference between an enlightened person and you. Now that's an enlightened person. They're so content, they want nothing. So how can you get to that point? What is actually the path to enlightenment? The point is that we have to let go of these desires, but we think, I don't want to let go. Why should I let go? So because of that, we have this sneaky, devious training to actually just to almost trick you into letting go. It's called meditation. Because sometimes people meditate here. They meditate here because they want to get rid of their cancers, they want to get happy, they want to have a better relationship with their partners, they want to do better in business, they want to get rid of their anger, sometimes even they want to get psychic powers. So they come and learn how to meditate. But no matter what you want in this meditation, it's always going on the same path. You start to let go a little. You start stopping your desires. And an amazing thing happens. When you let go of your desires just a tiny bit, you get so peaceful and happy. Now many of you, this is going towards the end of the retreat, many of you have had those moments when the meditation has been so easy, so calm, so peaceful, sometimes the happiest you've ever felt when you look at it. Why? It's because you've been so content you didn't want anything. Just like that fifth child in the wishing game. I wish I was so content I never needed any more wishes. Have you ever had a time in your life, some place, some time, when you're just sitting there and there's no other place in the world you want to be? You don't need anything more. Everything in this moment is absolutely perfect. Feelings, moments of utter contentment and peace. You may have had one or two of those moments, but isn't it frightening how rare they are? And how most of our life, most of our moments, we are utterly discontent, always wanting something more, wanting to go somewhere else, wanting to be with somebody different, even wanting to ourselves to be different, not even being content with ourselves. That's called suffering. But there are moments when you're so content, you feel this beautiful peace. That is the taste of nibbana. The taste of freedom. The taste of happiness. Utter contentment. If you haven't felt that in your daily life, you do feel that in your meditation. Sometimes you're sitting here, and people have done this in this retreat. They've been sitting here even though they haven't eaten all afternoon or evening. Even though they should be hungry, they're sitting here at breakfast time and they're so happy they don't want to go to breakfast. They're so content they don't want to move. Now can you understand how deep this contentment is? Some of you, if breakfast or lunch or dinner was an hour late, you get upset. Your tummy will start rumbling, oh, where's my dinner? I need my dinner. I want my dinner. Where's my dinner? Sometimes you're so content, you don't want anything. That is a taste of the peace and the happiness, the freedom of enlightenment. A strange thing happens. You find the happiness, the real happiness of life, comes from not wanting things. From peace, from contentment. And that's why you hear this saying of the Buddha, that peace is the highest happiness, contentment is the greatest wealth. You heard those teachings and now you're gaining insight into their meaning from your experience. So the first thing is that we learn about this contentment and we learn where it comes from. Not from wanting things, but from letting go. We get a vision of the Dhamma, an understanding of the path. This is what happened to me. Now just when I first meditated, the first time again was in the university. I remember it very clearly. This is how important it was to me. It was in the Wordsworth room of King's College in Cambridge. I sat only for 5 minutes. But it was so peaceful, I thought this is important to me. is more important than girls. As an 18-year-old boy. It was so important to me that I followed an 18-year-old boy. It was so important to me that I followed that path, thinking this might be the secret of happiness, of freedom, of nirvana. And my goodness, it was. This is the path. So we meditate in order to see the Dhamma of peace, of freedom, of ease. It goes in the opposite direction that most people in the world go. Sometimes that people think that all you yogis are absolutely crazy. You had 9 days of holiday. Why didn't you go to New York? Why didn't you go to Langkawi? Why didn't you go to some beach somewhere and just sun yourself? Why didn't you go partying? Some of your parents, of you young kids, say, why aren't you at the nightclubs chasing a partner in life? Sometimes people don't understand why people are so happy coming to a retreat. But you go back and you show that happiness to others. Sometimes it's the happiest thing you've ever experienced. When you let go and you find this deep sense of peace within. In the Dhamma, the Buddha gave this beautiful simile. It was a simile of the 7 shipwrecked sailors. It's a simile which describes what enlightenment is, and also the path to enlightenment. In this simile, there are 7 shipwrecked sailors. The actual sutta doesn't say they're shipwrecked, they're just in the water, a long way from land. And I made up the shipwreck, because how else would they be in the water a long way from home? But nevertheless, 7 shipwrecked sailors. The first one goes straight down. Shipwreck sailor number 2 goes up and then goes down. Goes up and goes down. Shipwreck sailor number 3 floats on the surface. Shipwreck sailor number 4, floating on the surface, looks around and sees land in the distance. Shipwreck sailor number 5, having seen land, starts swimming towards that land. Shipwreck sailor number 6 is so close to dry land, he's actually in the surf. He doesn't need to swim anymore. He can stand up, there's solid ground underneath him. He's wading to the shore. And the last shipwreck sailor number 7 has made it to dry land. He's sitting under the coconut tree, having a nice drink and a rest, reading a magazine, whatever else you want to do when you're in the beach. I made up those extra things for the last shipwreck sailor, but it counts. In this simile, those 7 shipwreck sailors represent the following. Shipwreck sailor number 1, who goes straight down, is someone who hasn't done much good karma, but has done a lot of bad karma. They don't keep afloat in life, but they go down. Shipwreck sailor number 2 is just the ordinary person. They've done some good karma, some bad karma. Now they go down, now they go up, now they go down, now they go up. Little yo-yos in the sea of life. Shipwreck sailor number 3, because they've done lots of good karma, they float, they keep their head above water. Whatever happens in this life, they manage to get through it without too much depression, frustration, anger, stress, illness and stuff like that. They're reasonably healthy, they're reasonably at peace, they're keeping their head above water because of their good karma, their precepts, their charity, their compassionate works. Shipwreck sailor number 4, the one who is floating above the water because they're good karma. Then you have the time to look around and see where is the dry land, where is safety. And this is the person who they call the stream winner. You've seen dry land, you've seen safety, you've seen the end of all this suffering. Shipwreck sailor number 5 is obvious consequence of shipwreck sailor number 4. The one up there as well. I can spot cameras, I've got a 6th sense or 7th sense for cameras. No paparazzi can catch me. So shipwreck sailor number 5 is the one who's seen the dry land and now who is swimming to the shore, is on the way to safety. And that represents the once returner, the Sakadagami, the second stage of enlightenment. Shipwreck sailor number, was it? 6. He's the one who is standing in the surf. I see you. Shipwreck sailor number 6 is the one who is standing in the surf, wading to the shore. They're so close to dry land it hardly matters. That's the Anagami, the non-returner. They're almost there. And shipwreck sailor number 7, under the coconut tree, sipping a cool draught of coconut, reading the magazines. The job has been done. That's the Arahat. They are safe. That's a beautiful description of the Buddha, which actually brings the path of enlightenment very clearly to our minds. It's not something which is hard to understand, because we understand that in our life we are unsafe. We have suffering, depressions, illnesses, stress, all this stuff which causes turmoil in our lives. Surely there must be some safety somewhere, some place where we can be free from all this suffering, dukkha and pain and arguments and self-hatred and guilt and fear and all this other stuff. So you make good karma, you can float above the surface long enough to be able to see dry land. You understand the goal of life. You see the destination. You see the freedom, the ending of desires. You understand why that is, what that is, the deep peace of Nibbana. When you understand that that is the ultimate happiness, what's going to happen next? You have to be striving towards that happiness. Sure, you can mess around sometimes, but if you know you're in the sinking in the water, you obviously be striving to get out, to get to dry land. A person who's on the way is called a once returner, but soon you're standing in the surf. You're still in the water, but almost out of the water. You're so close, the non-returner. And lastly, it's the Arahat, fully enlightened. And you know a person has got to these stages. Number one, you know a person's a once-returner because they're doing something about it. They're actually practicing. They're letting go of their desires and their cravings. They're letting go of their anger. You know a person's an Anagami because they're so pure-hearted, they're not attached to anything much in the world. You know a person's an Arahat because they never get angry. They never get upset. They're not craving at all. Which is why that sometimes we test people out. Because sometimes there's so many people come up and say they're stream winners or the once returners or they're fully enlightened. And sometimes people ask me that. Is this monk, is this nun, is this teacher? What do you think, Ajahn Brahm, are they enlightened? And I'll tell you how you can find out. Do you want to find out? You try and make them angry. You try and upset them. You try and get some anger out of them. That's actually the traditional manner. If somebody went up to Ajahn Chah and said, I've made it, I've cracked it, I'm enlightened. He said, you stupid idiot, you don't get enlightened. Go away, you idiot. In front of everybody. He'd do his utmost to make them angry. Just like in this classic story from Japanese Buddhism or Chinese Buddhism. Many, many years ago, there was a young monk who was so intent upon enlightenment. He was not going to mess around. So he asked his abbot if he can go, not just 6 months in solitude like I did, 3 years in solitude, or actually however long it took. And there was a little island in a lake close to the monastery. He said, let me build a little hut there, a little hermitage. After I've built the hermitage, please let me stay there, just to meditate, to study, to become enlightened. All I need, he said, just send over one of the attendants once a week, just for some supplies. I won't need much, just to look after myself, so I can have perfect seclusion. And the abbot agreed. So there, this diligent young monk, having built his hermitage, he would be alone in solitude, in this little island, surrounded by a lake, perfect solitude, to meditate all day and all night if he wanted to, just striving for enlightenment. He was such a diligent, such a a devoted meditator that after a while he got very peaceful. After a while, insight started to come. After a while, he realized he was enlightened. It was after 3 years, Lisette decided he needed to tell his master, the abbot, about his great attainment. So when the attendant came 1 week to bring the supplies, the monk Rota asked the attendant if he could next week bring some fine paper, some ink, and a fine quill. He wanted to write a message. 1 week later, the supplies came, but also a fine piece of parchment, some ink, and a quill. He meditated for 6 whole days to prepare his mind for what he was going to do next. And when his mind was still, when his mind was full of the joy of release, he took out the parchment, dipped the quill in the ink, and wrote the following poem in the most exquisite of calligraphy. The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the 4 worldly winds. The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the 4 worldly winds. In Buddhism, that was a sign that he was enlightened. Nothing could ever move him again. When he finished that calligraphy, when it dried, he looked at it. He smiled, rolled it up, tied it with a ribbon, and waited for the attendant to come. He gave the attendant the scroll, and then he sat and waited for the 7 days for the answer to come back. He was sure that his abbot would now probably invite him to take over the monastery himself. He'd probably think that maybe if that wasn't the case, he'd be invited to take over a big monastery in the capital. He was enlightened. Perhaps that scroll in the most exquisite of calligraphy would be put in an expensive frame and hung in the main Dhamma hall of the monastery. It was so wonderful to have made it at last. 1 week later, the attendant came back. The monk was beside himself with excitement because the attendant gave him a piece of parchment back with a different colour ribbon on the outside. Hurriedly, the monk opened it. He read the parchment. It was his own parchment, but the abbot had scrawled some words over his poem. Over the first line, which said, "The diligent monk," the abbot had written the 4 letters, F-A-R-T, in red biro pen. He couldn't believe his eyes. On the second line, "Alone for 3 years," the abbot had scrawled in capital letters the same word, "Fart." The third line had the same 3 letters, even in bigger characters, with an exclamation mark after it, "Fart." And the last line had the same, this time underlined, "Fart." This was too much. This abbot was so stupid, he couldn't even see enlightenment when it was in front of his fat, stupid nose, and he'd made a mess of this exquisite calligraphy, which was a work of art, defiling it with graffiti, which was a work of a punk, not a monk. He was not going to stand for this. He ordered the attendant to row him back. He was going to see this abbot. This was the first time he left the monastery in 3 years. He stormed into the abbot's office. He slammed the parchment on the table and demanded an explanation. And the abbot very slowly picked up the parchment and stood up. And he read it out to the irate young monk. "The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the 4 worldly winds, yet 4 little farts has blown you clean over the lake." He was blown across the lake by 4 little farts. And he realized, oh, I'm not enlightened, so he went back over there and stayed a few more years in Jnana.
This is a classic case of how we find out if someone's enlightened or not. Try and make them angry. Now, that's actually if you want to test somebody out to see if they're enlightened or not. See if they get angry. Many, and I'm going to tell you the story now of my enlightenment. Do you want to hear this story? Some of you heard it before. I was very quick. I was only a monk, 4 years as a monk. And I was meditating in this very remote and simple forest monastery in the northeast of Thailand. There was not much work to do there. It was our rains retreat. And I was putting forth immense effort in my meditation. One evening, after the service in the evening had finished, after most of the monks had gone to bed, I was walking meditation. Sometimes this happens. You're walking backwards and forwards, and your mind gets so still and open, full of energy. First one insight came up, which was very, very powerful. And it was followed by another and then another. It was as if a whole waterfall, a fountain of insights would just flow. I couldn't resist them, one after the other. And then, after about half an hour, the big one came. The big insight. Wow, that blew me away. I was almost crying with joy. So peaceful. So clear. This was it. Enlightenment. I was just so happy, so at peace. It was late in the night. You should go to sleep because the morning bell went at 3 o'clock. Went up to my hut to lay down. I don't know if I did really sleep, just lay down. So peaceful, so mindful. This was in the tropics. Usually in the monsoon season up there. Now, I was an English-born monk. Sometimes it's so oppressive, you get so sleepy. No way was I going to get sleepy. I think I got up about 2:15. Went into the hall. You know, didn't mind any mosquitoes, the heat. You just sat meditation there. Very often, that time in the morning, you'd be nodding, sleepy. No nodding that morning. I was bolt upright. With ease, no effort at all. You just watch the breath, you notice it so easily, without any obstacles whatsoever. Deep meditation. Ah, it's so wonderful being enlightened. We went on alms round that morning. Just so peaceful. Everyone who put food in my bowl, I was just sapping them with loving kindness. Because that's what you do when you're enlightened, just give loving kindness to everybody. Oh, it's so nice. All of you may all be peaceful and happy. And then came our meal. And what was really surprising that morning, that usually the food in that part of the world 30 years ago was absolutely disgusting. I've already mentioned the story of the frog and rice. The usual fare we got was usually, we had a bowl of sticky rice. The only other thing we had was a pot of rotten fish curry. And it was made out of rotten fish. What they used to do was actually to catch fish only in the paddy fields in the rainy season. And they'd store it throughout the rest of the year. And this was the beginning of the rainy season. They were still using the fish caught the year before. What they used to do, just put it in an earthenware pot, and then just put a piece of plastic over it. I found one of those pots once in the monastery where I was cleaning up. It was full of maggots. The plastic had broken. The flies had laid their eggs in there. It was crawling with maggots. So I picked it up to throw it away. As it happened, the head man of the village, the most educated, knowledgeable, refined man in the whole village, saw me. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Look, it's got maggots in it. I'm throwing it away." He said, "Give it to me. That's extra protein." The next morning, we had rotten fish curry. It was rotten. It smelt rotten. and it tasted rotten. So he said, but that's all you had. Just border sticky rice and rotten fish curry. But that morning, the morning of my enlightenment, we had two pots. Now, as you know, I was a vegetarian before I was a monk. In those places, there was no vegetarian food. The other pot was a pot of pork curry. Something delicious at last. The immediate thought, this was very rare, how can we have two pots this day? I thought, I know why. The Devas are celebrating my enlightenment. There's only explanation. So they had these two pots of curry. Now in the monasteries, the senior monk takes their share first of all, then they pass it down to the second monk, who pass it down to the third monk. Even though I'd only been a monk for four years, I was number two in line. And I saw this abbot, who was a local boy born in that village, who I thought should like rotten fish curry. He turned his nose, sniffed at the rotten fish curry. He wasn't going to have any of that. And he took four whopping ladles of this pork curry. Greedy pig. That's what I thought, I must admit. But I thought, it doesn't matter, there's plenty left for me, because I'm number two, I'll soon get some. And then, what this fellow did, I couldn't believe. Having taken four big ladlefuls for himself first, then he poured the rest of the pork curry in the same pot as the rotten fish curry, stirred it up and said, it's all the same anyway. What do you mean it's all the same anyway, you hypocrite? If it was the same, you'd have mixed it up first before you took yours. Oh, I was so upset at this monk. Because what really gets me is hypocrisy. He says one thing and does another thing, and worse, he spoiled my celebratory... Uh-oh, I thought. Then it hit me. Arahats are not supposed to get angry. Arahats are not supposed to worry about what they eat. I was, and I was angry too. All my anger completely disappeared. So did my worry about what I ate. Realizing I wasn't enlightened after all, spoiled my whole day. It only lasted for a few hours, such a shame. But it was the anger and the disappointment which proved to me, no, I wasn't enlightened after all. Thank you so much for that abbot for teaching me about enlightenment and making me angry. That's how you find out. If you've still got defilements inside of you, you are not enlightened. If you've got anger, or craving, desire, you obviously aren't enlightened at all. That is how you find out. You watch a person over all those years, especially when it's a time they should get angry or should get afraid. Once when Ajahn Chah, he only went to the West once. He went to England when our monks first went over there. He insisted going on arms round in Hampstead. He was walking an arms round, and this, well, you might call him a yob, this young delinquent, came up to him and started teasing him because he was wearing girls' clothes. It was a dress, isn't it? We wore skirts. And in England they thought that was girls' clothes. And Ajahn Chah just kept on walking. And then this young man punched Ajahn Chah. Just past his nose. What? Ajahn Chah didn't know he was trying to miss. Then he tried to kick him. Again, just missing him. And Ajahn Chah afterwards, he just didn't move, he just carried on walking. Because he was a great monk. He said afterwards, I'm going to send all of my monks to England. This is a great place to test monks out. Of course, it only happened that one time. But that's where you find out if someone's enlightened or not. And sometimes it's very hard to tell. There was one of these cases in Sri Lanka, in probably the best meditation monastery some years ago, in Mitrigala. If any of you know that meditation monastery, it's still there, but it was a very, very strong, powerful monastery when the previous abbot was there, things went on Yanarama, I think his name was, if I remember correctly. This very interesting case happened because there was a couple of monks with me who were there at the time. There's a couple of temple boys who were working in this monastery. Now, because this is what boys do, they work in a monastery, they get accommodation, they get food, and they go to school at the same time during the day. So if they come from a poor family, at least they get some support. But these two boys were actually very interested in the Dhamma. So they went up to see the teacher one day and said, listen, we're not just here studying, we'd like to hear the Dhamma, we'd like to meditate. Can you give us some instructions on meditation? Now, most temple boys in Sri Lanka are notoriously lazy. So this was quite something that the temple boy, or two of them, wanted to learn meditation. So this great and most famous meditation master at that time in Sri Lanka gave them some meditation instruction. And these boys did very well. After another couple of weeks, they came there, reported their progress, and it was really encouraging. So the teacher gave them more instructions. These two young men started getting very deep in meditation and getting all these amazing insights. Soon, the word was going around the monastery that these two boys were streamers. The teacher confirmed it. Soon, they'd become non-returners. And they said, the monks who were there at the time said, you couldn't believe the electric atmosphere in that monastery when the teacher confirmed they were both arahat. Two young boys must have had enormous good karma, paramitas, that together they got this highest of attainment. And all these monks said, what a wonderful thing, we've got two more enlightened beings in Sri Lanka to teach the Dhamma. And they're so young, they can do so much for the world. According to the tradition, which is believed in Sri Lanka, if you become enlightened as a layperson, you've got till the next dawn to become a monk or a nun, or you die. So as soon as Venwanyana Rama confirmed they were arahats, he actually ordered a car. He drove to the main monastery. In Sri Lanka, it's so difficult to get an ordination. He went to the main monastery, got out the preceptor, and demanded an ordination on the spot for these two young boys. He was convinced they were fully enlightened, and if he didn't ordain them that day, there was no time to waste, they would die. It would be such a waste for the Buddhism. So, on a very, very rare occasion, I don't know if it's happened before, these two boys were immediately ordained as bhikkhus. So it was novices, I think they were young, novices. They were put in the robes. And everyone was so inspired. Two more arahats in the world. However, we found out later on they weren't fully enlightened. Because what had actually happened, because they were just, the word got around, people came to look after them. One of these temple boys had a very minor ailment. One of the doctors, the supporters from Colombo, came to see him and said, look, it's a very simple ailment, but we can cure it. We just have to take you into a hospital and do a little operation. Now this was a boy from the village. He didn't understand what operation was. He didn't understand about anesthetic. He thought that you just cut things out with a knife when you're just sitting there or lying back on your back. He started to get afraid. Very scared. And that made it very clear the boy wasn't an arahat after all. Soon the other defilements came up. And they were very disappointed that both of them eventually they found they weren't enlightened. But the point of that story, their experiences were so close, they fooled even the greatest monk in Sri Lanka at the time. Now this is actually a warning to everybody. Sometimes it's so hard to tell who's enlightened or not. Sometimes you have to live with a person for many, many years. There are signs, obviously. They don't have greed, they don't have hatred. They're very wise, they're very peaceful, they never get angry at anybody. They live very simply, they've got few possessions like Ajahn Chah. It's very easy to tell a person is not enlightened. That is easy to see. But to say a person is enlightened, you have to check for many, many years. Even for yourself, you have to check for many, many years. If lust comes up, sorry, you're not enlightened. If you get angry, no. But where that enlightenment actually comes from, to link it from yesterday's talk, the enlightened process, when I say seeing the Dhamma, it's actually either seeing the Four Noble Truths or seeing impermanence, especially seeing the emptiness called non-self. That's why the first stage of enlightenment is just the purification of your view, seeing non-self to its very core. What actually happens is that the two causes for stream winning are the words of another, in other words, the teachings of a Buddha or their disciples, plus this word yonisamanasikara, the work of the mind which goes to the source of who you think you are, what I call the doer and the knower, will and consciousness. That's the source of you. I mentioned yesterday, the creator of this world is craving. Coming from delusion, dependent origination, it's a craving which drives evolution, which changes species. That craving is once, sorry, beyond that, that craving called the doing, your will, that's one of those sources. And the other one is the knowing, the knower. This is where we have the delusion of we existing. Well, the Buddha said, you find these five khandhas, the body, feeling, perception. You find mental formations, in particular will, and consciousness, knowing, is not me, not mine, not a self. That is the attainment, the wisdom, the insight, which makes one a stream winner. What happens is that because of your deep meditation, you see these things which you took to be a self. You see your mistake. It's like the blind spot. At the time, you can't see it. You think you understand anatta, you think you understand suffering, you understand impermanence. But you're missing something. It's like a fellow monk of mine. He was a Vietnam vet in the US Marines. He fought in the front lines of the Vietnam War. In one occasion, during the fight, he was shot in the back of the head. The back of his head caved in. Fortunately, he was evacuated very quickly in a helicopter, taken to the Marine Hospital, I think it was in Tokyo at the time, or maybe Okinawa, sorry, where he woke up being operated on. When he came to, he was back in the US. He had got very little memory of what happened at this time. Because he was a Marine, a tough guy, the doctor said, I'm sorry, son, you're going to be blind. Because his brain was damaged, they took out all this dead brain stuff in the area which is supposed to dominate your visual sense. He told me that he decided as soon as he had the chance, he was not going to live as a blind person, he was going to commit suicide. He'd resolved on that, he was so tough, he would do it without any problem. However, when they took the bandages off his eyes, to the doctor's surprise, as much as his, he could see. His vision was not impaired. So, as soon as he was healthy enough to leave the hospital, he was outside of the army with a $1,000 a month pension, which at those days meant he could do whatever he wanted. He went all over the world, enjoying himself, young, fit, attractive, having fun. But he said, and this is one of the reasons I tell this story, he was playing baseball with some friends. And the batter hit the ball high in his direction. It was a catch, there for the taking. He followed the ball with his eyes to catch it. And he said the strangest thing happened. The ball disappeared from the universe. It vanished. And he couldn't believe his eyes, but then, a second or two later, it reappeared along its trajectory. He realized from that experience, and from others coming afterwards, he had a blind spot. The wound had actually destroyed part of his field of vision. But he said it was a strange thing to know that when you have a blind spot, you cannot see it. A certain area in your field of vision should be a black hole, but no, perception fills it in with what it expects to see there. He could actually, perception saw the sky just as you expect to see. But he never expected the ball, so actually the ball disappeared. And that's the only way he found out he had a blind spot. If any of you had a blind spot, you don't know it, except by inference, because your perception, your mind, fills in what it expects, what should be there. And that was my wonderful simile for delusion. You have a blind spot in your understanding of Dhamma, especially self and non-self. You simply can't see it, and you don't know you can't see it. Later on, with deep meditation, you notice that blind spot. You find out there was something you took to be you, a self, which had no reason to be taken as you. You see all the five khandhas completely in every which way. It's not me, not mine, not the self. Those insights are like explosions going on in the mind. Just like that insight which I had, which I thought was enlightenment, which wasn't, my 4 years as a monk. Just incredible peace, incredible happiness. You think you know everything. Just like an explosion. All your delusion seems to disappear. But you have to wait until the dust settles before you know if any of those hindrances and defilements are still there. Sometimes it takes months, even years. You've got to wait to see whether there is any self-view left. When you see non-self, emptiness, you also see the far shore. That is the insight which makes one a stream winner. When you know there's no one in there, and I really mean no one, only then can you start to let go properly. It's impossible to let go when you think you exist. You cannot let go. Because you is what does the attaching. I mentioned this earlier in another talk. Sometimes we think of attachment and grasping as what we pick up on that end of the hand. We never really look at what's doing the picking up and the attaching. If you see what's doing the attaching and the grasping, it's you, the self. As long as there's a you there, an idea of me, you will always be grasping on something. The only way to unwind the cause of samsara is to abandon, see through the delusion of self. When that is abandoned, the whole process of samsara unravels. We have 7 lifetimes at most. If you're slow, once you see non-self to the full, a stream winner. Because there's no self in there, it's not a part of your choice. You can't will it to go faster or slower. You can't will yourself, oh, may I stay much longer in samsara. It's not up to you because it wasn't up to you to begin with. There is no self or will in there at all. There's no self actually willing. Because of that, 7 lifetimes at most. The closer you go, the more you let go of, the closer you are to Nibbana. And finally, you completely let go of everything. There's no self. You're not holding on to anything anymore. No anger, no ill will, no lust, no desire. Which means that when you pass away from this world, everything stops. Ceases. Sometimes people always ask that question. When an enlightened person dies, where do they go? The Buddha answered this very clearly. He said, when a flame nibbanas, the word for a flame being extinguished is called nibbana. The word nibbana in the time of the Buddha was understood by every villager. It was a common term. It was a term they used when the oil lamp went out. When a flame goes out, where does it go? Does it go to the unconditioned realm where all flames go when they go out? Does it go to flame heaven? Does it go to the non-manifest flameless? Does it go to the ineffable home of all flames? When a flame goes out, it doesn't exist anymore, that's all. Because the Buddha made this very clear. A flame depends upon three things. It depends upon the wick, very clear. A flame depends upon three things. It depends upon the wick. It depends upon the oil or the wax. And it depends upon the heat. Those three things must come together. Heat, wax, wick. And it said when any one of those upadanas, fuel is another word for craving, for attachment. When any one of those fuels is taken away, when the wick is depleted, when the wax is exhausted, or when a wind takes the heat away, then the flame stops. It ceases. It nirodhas, ceases. So that's the same as a flame which you call you. Dependent upon things, when those causes are taken away, the flame stops. Nibbana. Poof, and you're gone. Someone says, well, what's the meaning of life then? Many years ago, when I was a young monk, I heard from some friends in California, there was this little machine they were selling in the knick-knack shops in San Francisco. It became an item which you had to have on your coffee table as a conversation piece when your friends came. They described this little machine, which was a fashion item in the best homes. It was a box, a metal box, a cube, which was flat and plain on all sides, except for a simple switch on one side. And of course, when your friends came round for coffee, they said, what's that? What does it do? And you were invited to flick the switch. When you flicked the switch, you could hear cogwheels inside this box. Things were moving. Soon a flap came out from the side and lifted up. And then a mechanical arm came around from the side, came to the front, turned off the switch and went back inside again. And it stopped. It was a machine whose sole purpose was to turn itself off. And I thought, what a wonderful simile for life. Do you understand that? No, you don't. But that's all you're getting for tonight. Enlightenment. Now that was a deep talk tonight. I told a few funny stories. But that's as deep as it gets. If you see non-self, you see the first shore. And then you go swimming for it, and then you're finished. You're ended. I say, what's the point? There was no one there to begin with, so there's no one there to end. What's the big deal? Any questions? Okay, question time now about enlightenment. Any questions? Have I bamboozled you? Yes, please. And upstairs, any questions, please? I can see you all there. Hi. Wave. Thank you. Nice to see you. They're waving at the top. Have any questions, please come to the microphone. Remember, all those people upstairs, you're closer to heaven. So you must be the creme de la creme.
Ajahn, this question is from the floor. What is Buddhist healing?
So what is Buddhist healing? Actually, I came from Ealing in London. But Buddhist healing, with a H, you've got to be very careful when you speak to Londoners because sometimes they drop the H's. Healing with a H, Buddhist healing, is where you use the power of the mind. It can be chanting, it can be metta, loving kindness. It can be your own power of the mind to heal yourself. Using the energy of mind to actually to ease some of the pain and sicknesses in the body. And Buddhists do a lot of healing. But the best healing is actually the mental healing. Again, this is an important part. Why It's good to give charity to monasteries because people say, no, let's give it to orphanages, to hospitals, say. They need it more. And I say, no, you don't understand. What happened, which changed my understanding, was when I went to India on pilgrimage, and many of you have been to India on pilgrimage, part of the pilgrimage, we went to Benares, we went on this boat ride on the Ganges. I never do that again because there's nothing Buddhist there, but afterwards, it was a very interesting experience. After landing, after the little boat ride at dawn, we walked through the back streets of Benares, and as soon as we started walking, all these very poor lepers came out, asking for money. These were real lepers, with dirty wounds, sleeping out on the streets, as poor, as deprived, as excluded as you can possibly get. And one of them came to me, they saw I was a Westerner, and they came up, rupee, rupee, rupee. And I, being a very silly monk, turned around and said, I haven't got any money, I'm a monk. I said it in English, thinking that sort of destitute beggars could speak English. That's how stupid I was. And this guy just gave me a toothless smile and said, rupee, rupee, rupee. It was a waste of time trying to speak with him. So I thought, what could I do to this guy? So I didn't have any rupees. There's a monk who doesn't keep any money. And I couldn't explain that to him. So all I did, I just put my arm around him. Just like as a Western, that sort of greeting of compassion. And I put my arm around him and gave him a smile. And he gave me this most beautiful, wonderful smile, which has stayed with me forever. And I thought afterwards, how on earth can a person in that situation smile like that? How can a leper, destitute, homeless, rejected from even other poor Indians, have such happiness inside of him? Because that's what that smile showed me. And I realized afterwards, when I got back to Perth, the suicide rate in Perth is far, far higher than the suicide rate in Benares. I thought, why? Why is it in a rich city where people have got health care, they've got good schools, they've got social services, they've got opportunities, beautiful beaches, everything you could ever hope for. Why in Perth do many people commit suicide where lepers are so happy? And I realized, especially with suicide, there is a type of sickness, a type of pain, which even is worse than leprosy. The pain which you can't stand. You can stand being a leper. There's some pain you can't stand. You have to kill yourself. That's the pain which you cannot see on the body. It's not marked with a limp or with a scar. It's not, I can't even see it with a fever. It's that invisible sickness, that pain which can be in any one of you here and no one can notice it. Depression, fear, loneliness, mental pain. When I saw that, I realized that it's the monasteries, the temples, places like this, which can heal a pain which no other hospital can. We can take away such suffering when you hear the Dhamma, which actually saves many, many lives. The thing in a hospital, you can see when people go in, you can see them sick. You can see them coming out healthy. In a temple, you can't see the sickness which they bring in here. You can't see the health which they take out. But don't think these places don't work. These places are huge hospitals for the mind. That's why it's good to support temples. As much as you support hospitals, even more, this is a hospital for the mind. And you know it works. Many people have told me, if they hadn't come and listened to Dhamma, they'd be dead by now. So yeah, I don't know where we started on that question, but it's a nice place to finish.
In fact, the questioner has got three. So I'll read all and...
Yeah, go on. Let's see which ones are good enough to answer.
The first one is, what is Buddhist healing? The next one is, if a healing work requires one to pay, would you go for the healing session as a monk?
Okay.
The next question, if a healer says that you have no common sense but cow sense, what do you do? Thank you.
If first of all, if healers ask for money, and if they say you have got no common sense, only cow sense, say that cows don't have money, moo off. No, because no, that sometimes that I really think that, you know, healing should be done for free. Because I can't see why a person should make money out of other people's suffering. I can't. So personally, anything which I give and do, you don't actually ask anything back in return. And sometimes it's true, sometimes people don't give anything as well. I went to this funeral service just before I came here. This Western man who died of cancer, he was only in his late 30s. His family were quite sort of distraught, and I really helped them out. I gave really extra to them, really looked after them, gave a great sort of funeral service for them. And then when they sort of came up to me afterwards and said, you know, how much do we have to pay? So it's all done by donation. You give whatever you like. So I didn't give anything. Westerners are like that sometimes, that, you know, if you don't give them an invoice, they'll never give you anything. But never mind, it's always a good story. But like, if anyone demands payment, there's always seems to be something wrong there, especially if it's a lot of money, just don't do that. You can get a far better service from monks like myself who don't charge at all. This is high quality, low price, the best possible deal you can get. But you know, sometimes, only just to cover costs, fair enough. But it's also, if they start saying you haven't got any common sense, you've only got cow sense, my goodness, and they want payment for that? So like kind, good people, healers, they should have loving kindness. And sometimes they know how to speak to you. They usually speak with kindness, with gentleness. You get much more out of a person with kindness than you do with abuse. I don't abuse my monks, and I get much more out of them by being kind, by encouraging. You try that with your husband. When you go home, say, oh dear husband, kind husband, nice husband. Well, you're such a wonderful husband. Now, would you mind if I get that nice dress in the shop? Yes, you get much more out of people when you're really sort of nice to them. That's what I found. Next question. Any question here? Yeah, go on. Anyone at the top there? Any questions up in heaven? No. The upper story is called the heaven of the contented. They are so contented up there, they don't ask questions. Yeah.
Ajahn Brahm, I have 3 points that I want you to clarify.
Oh my goodness.
The first one relates to the various stages of enlightenment, starting with Sotapanna right down to Arahat.
Yeah.
But the question actually relates to the first three stages.
Mm-hmm.
It may appear to be a very rude, but I ask out of ignorance.
Uh-huh. Something's coming on.
Are there any documentary evidence to support the teaching that Osotapanna has a maximum of 7 lives, then there is a once returner and a non-returner? And are we just to follow this teaching out of pure faith through meditation?
Okay, I'll answer that first question first.
Thank you.
And again, that the only way that you can understand, there is documentary evidence in the suttas and in the Tipitaka, but sometimes the people can't actually take that as absolute, because it's just what somebody else said, even though it's supposed to be the word of the Buddha, and I think it is the word of the Buddha, I've got great faith in those teachings, but nevertheless people say, well, you know, you might as well have faith in the Bible or faith in some other document. The only faith which works is actually your own experience. And if you actually even get to being a stream winner, you will understand why that is true. The thing is that when we're so far away, we can't really understand exactly what it is and why it is. But I guarantee this, if you become a stream winner, especially if you overcome this idea of like the will being the person in control of you, you understand this is a natural process. It's like a law of science, like a law of physics. You know, what goes up comes down. You can actually chart the course of a projectile in space. It goes according to natural laws. And you know, just the the stars or the, you know, the planets, they can't just suddenly decide to change course. There's laws, cause and effect, understandable reasons why this happens. And if the understanding which will give you the clue to understanding why this happens is a full understanding of non-self, and the way that will actually works. So you can't change this, it's a natural process. Once that self-delusion has been overcome, you cannot maintain craving anymore. It's like undermined. It's like you've got a car and the gas runs out. You can keep driving that car for a while, it's got its momentum, but you know, if there's no more gas in the car, there's no way to fill it up, that car has to come to a stop. 7 blocks or 1 block, it's going to come to a stop.
Would I be correct then to conclude from what you have just explained? You practice through faith, then you have to experience.
Yeah.
Then only the other things will fall in place.
Correct, yes.
Thank you.
Very
now,
good.
The next question relates to, or the next clarification, I would say, yes, relates to the fact that I've observed over a number of times that you don't mention much about chanting. Any special reason for that?
Okay. Now that chanting is quite useful as an adjunct, in other words, as a help, as a supporting condition. But really, the main path of Buddhism, again, sometimes people say, oh, it's vipassana, sometimes it's chanting. It's very good to go to the heart of the Buddha's teachings, the earliest Buddhist teachings, where everyone agrees on. The path to enlightenment is the Eightfold Path. So that's what we always try and teach, Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path. As I was saying yesterday, whether you're practicing Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, the Bodhisattva Path, Sila Samadhi Panya, the Eightfold Path is in there as well. This is what's common to all Buddhist traditions. So this is what you try and always focus on, which is, you know, right view, right intention, right speech, action, livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right letting go. So that's what you focus on. Chanting could be part of that, but it's, as it were, sort of not central to the path. You don't need to throw away your chanting. It's great to do chanting. But central part is your precepts, your meditation and your wisdom. Because sometimes people chant and they don't know what they're chanting. Because there was this case in Thailand some years ago. People were chanting the 5 precepts. And because if you go to a temple when other people were chanting the 5 precepts, everyone had to chant the 5 precepts, but hardly anyone was keeping them. So they worked out a system because they thought, well, if I'm going to take the 5 precepts, but I'm lying, that's very bad karma. And the Thais were very scared of bad karma. So they got this system of how you can actually chant the 5 precepts without keeping them all. You'd see them with their hands up like this, but sometimes they'd have 1 finger down. That meant they'd only keep 4 precepts. They still chant them all, but that was almost like the fingers behind the back. You know, the 1 precept they weren't going to keep. Unfortunately, when I found that out, I saw some people with 2 fingers down. You even saw some people chanting with all their fingers down. Oh, crazy. So sometimes the chanting can be just like the ritual, which hasn't got any meaning. And that means it doesn't work at all. It's better not done. But if you understand what you're chanting, how many people chant Om Mani Padme Hum but don't know a word what it means? It's important to find the meaning first of all, and then the chanting is meaningful. Yeah, go on.
What is the meaning of the Om Mani Padme Hum?
No, I told that meaning last night, the jewel in the lotus, yeah. And that jewel is emptiness, you're the lotus.
Oh,
yes, lotus, please say again.
The third point, the work of faith healers, is this some deva that has entered the physical body of the person who performs faith healing. What are your comments on this?
Okay, faith healing, there's many types of faith healing, but I think the one I said about yesterday, about that experiment which was done in the United States, which I think it was last night I mentioned that, or was it this morning? This morning, okay, it was on question time. In, I forget the journal now, some journal, I think the Western Journal of Psychiatry, I think it was called. It was in, anyway, December 1998. It was an experiment which was done in the US, in California, where a number of, religious people, which included Buddhist monks, Christian priests, Jewish rabbis, and indigenous Americans, that's what we used to call Red Indians, were asked to do some chanting, some praying, some form of distant healing for some people who were in hospital suffering from AIDS. The priests were given a list of names to chant for, to pray for, to do some dance for, whatever, I don't know how they did their healing. Half the names were false, half were true. In other words, half were real patients suffering from AIDS in the hospitals of California. Some were just made up. Of the target group, AIDS sufferers in the hospital, of the great group, half were being chanted for, half weren't. Half were the control group. And they gave the doctors looking after these sufferers a simple questionnaire, which was basically, in your opinion, over 2 weeks, has this patient improved better than expected, as expected, or less than expected? So they could actually find whether this chanting had any effects. It's a huge sample group. And the patients did not know they were being chanted on. The monks, the priests, the rabbis, the Indians, they didn't know whether what they were chanting on was a real person or not. But the result was so significant, it was published in Time magazine, where I first saw it, and then I saw it in the, I got it from the internet, and got the actual scientific article. The chanting, the healing, worked. A significant increase in the health, if those people were being chanted for, prayed for. It made no difference, it was a Buddhist chanting, Christian healing, indigenous Indians, or Jewish ceremonies. And I mentioned this morning because sometimes people come along and say, oh, the Christian priests say that if you believe in God we can heal other people, but Buddhists can't. The point is, it's scientific fact, it does not matter whether you're a Christian or a Buddhist, whoever you are, and most of us are saying, if you can think of that other person, you chant to focus the energies of your mind to wish them well, yes, it works. It's not a matter of a God, it's a matter of your power. The power of your mind. You're the one who does the healing. You have that ability, you have that power, whether it's called loving kindness or whatever else you call it, to affect others. And they did that and they found it works. Mind to mind.
Yes. I owe you an apology. I didn't clarify myself. I say faith healing by touch.
Faith healing by touch. Even... Even the fact that somebody cares for you, when it's actually so direct, there's so many other possible explanations. Just the fact that, you know, that somebody cares for you with touch, whenever anyone touches you gently, that by itself is therapeutic. It doesn't matter, no powers, but just, you know, the human body warms to touch. It warms, because that settles you. Remember when you were a kid, your mother would touch you? I remember when I was a child, if I, you know, playing soccer in the streets, because it was a poor part of London, you sometimes play in the streets, you fall over and you, you know, scrape the skin off your knee. And as a 6 or 7 year old, you go crying to your mother, Mom! And all she would do, she'd bend down and kiss it. Put all the germs of her mouth on the open wound. I only found that out afterwards, but it worked. As soon as you did that, the pain went away and the whole thing healed up. That was faith healing. Because I had faith in my mum. So yeah, it can work on so many different levels.
Is there some intervention by the deva? Because I've known a person, when he touches, or when she touches you, you feel heat going through your body. Yes. How do you explain that?
That's the energy from her. Her own energy.
It's Reiki energy I was told.
Yeah, Reiki energy. But a lot of times people think it's from devas, but it's from your own energies, your own mind. Oh. People have a huge amount of power in their mind, they just don't use it, that's all. We don't know how to. Our mind's all over the place. Thinking about this, thinking about that, always complaining, using up our energies. We've got a huge amount of power. If we only focus it, people who have been meditating sometimes can feel that power. This is one experiment which I'm going to do tomorrow morning. I'll let you know this in advance. We've been doing a loving kindness meditation just about, it was after the chanting, maybe 5:45. Tomorrow morning, somewhere during the loving kindness meditation, I'm going to ask you to think very strongly of a loved one. Spend lots of loving kindness to them. Really put heaps of kindness and care for them. And when we're in the middle of that, I'm going to stop and I'm going to look at my clock. And I'm going to tell you what the time is. I might even write it down myself. And then, when you go home tomorrow evening, or when you next see that person, I want you to ask them, if you don't mind me asking, what were you doing at, say, 6 o'clock on Sunday morning? If they were sleeping, they'd say, that's funny, I was dreaming of you. If they're awake, they say, I was thinking of you. I've done this many times. It's incredible how well it works. And actually, the reason I do this is actually just to give people confidence and faith that, yeah, they can influence somebody. You can actually take a loved one, I can get you really strong in your loving kindness, and I'd give you the time. You check it out afterwards. Yeah, at that time, they were thinking of you, they felt good. Many times that's happened. And you can do it yourself to actually prove it. It's your energy.
Thank you very much, Ajahn Brahm.
Very good.
Been very patient with me. May you always be happy and well.
Always. Ah, doesn't give me much freedom. Kind of be miserable from time to time. No, come on. Yes.
The question. This afternoon when I was doing walking meditation in front of the stage, suddenly my energy, the chi vibrating hard and my fingers was pricking hard. Then I realized that I was passing you. I realized that God's energy was so strong. Does it have healing effect?
There we go, that proves it. Now she says she got some energy, a burst of energy from me. There are energy places in this world and they're built up by people. I mentioned to many of you about that 6 months when I spent in my hut in Australia, alone, not speaking to anybody, not seeing anyone for 6 months. I said this, I think, in the question time, so people in the back haven't heard this story. After the 6 months was completed, of all that energy in that hut, great samadhi energy, the fellow monks in my monastery, I found out later, were wheeling and dealing, trying to be the next person to sit in that hut. To get a buzz from that energy to help with their own meditation. And the monk who actually managed to get that hut after I left, he said he went down there, he couldn't go in. The energy was just too strong for him. And this was a monk. He was a German monk, been a monk for many years. He was one of the monks from Mitragala. He said, ooh, it was too much. Yeah, there is such a thing as energy. And you've got it. Not just monks. So make use of it. You had a question? You're saying we do the metta tomorrow, can we do our departed loved ones? If it's departed loved ones, you can't really go and ask them at that time. What were you thinking? But, of course, you can do departed loved ones with loving kindness. We can do that inside or at the end of the meditation. You can do that. Do with someone who's senile. Sometimes people who are senile, they have these moments of clarity. Sometimes that moment might be a moment they're extra clear. Give it a try. I love experimenting with things you're not supposed to do. Senile people aren't supposed to be able to feel this. Give it a try. Who knows? They may actually be acting on a different level, not just on their brain, upon their mind. The brain may be senile, but never the mind. Underneath all of that is a strong mind. Give it a try. Any other questions? Yes. Please come to the microphone. And if you, because there's only a few minutes left, you have, maybe have to queue up at the microphone.
Hi, Zen Brand.
Rush there, otherwise you may not get there. Yes, hello, how are you?
Hi, thank you. I'm fine.
Very good.
I've got a slight problem with trying to get my brains around this concept of anatta, which I have following.
Very good.
The talk last night.
Yeah.
If I may relate a personal experience, which is why it's giving me problems. Many years ago, when I was a student in Leeds, I had a what I thought must be an out-of-body experience. However, I wasn't on drugs. I was, I think, in the middle of an exams, and for many nights, 3 or 4 nights, I was having this feeling of the soul, I thought, trying to come out, and it was a great fear. And on the 4th night, I gave up. I thought, let's see where it can go. So it comes out. I was hovering around in the bedroom, seeing my own body, and then I was scared of heights, but still, I thought, let it go. And whoosh, it went out the window, went up and down the street. You can see the post office, the fish and chip shop. And after hovering for a while, I came back in and I thought, that was a fun experience. So I tried it again the next few nights, and eventually it stopped when a mate of mine told me, try eating some salt. And sure enough, it stopped. My question is, in the context of anatta, non-self, no soul, is that a stream of consciousness? Or if it's a stream of consciousness, does it need to have a vehicle to travel on, which is, I thought, up to now, the soul?
Okay, very good question. Actually, if you were doing that just before the exams, you should have sent your astral body to the examination room to look at the look at the exam papers and come back again. That would save you a lot of trouble. They would not have known you were there. But no, it is what the Buddha called a manomayakaya, the mind-made body. So this is actually similar to what happens to you when you die, floating above your body. And you find it's interesting, the Buddha was very precise. He said, it's just like you take a reed, like a piece of grass, out from its sheath. So you look exactly the same as the body lying down there. Even to the point, if you were wearing those clothes on your bed, you'd be wearing those clothes in this mind-made body. You had a beard, you hadn't shaved before you sort of left your body. Your mind-made body would need shaving as well. Basically, exact replica. Don't know exactly why that is, but the Buddha noticed that and said that. But that is the stream of consciousness. In other words, it's not a soul. The difference, it's not that much different than a soul, as far as you're concerned. But watch, the way it is really different is that that stream of consciousness, what people think is a soul, is actually always changing. In other words, there's nothing in that experience which is always, was there at the beginning, which is there at the end. The simile which is usually given from our experience from nature is the river. If you look at the river, the Klang River yesterday, it looks exactly the same as today. Sometimes, if you don't look deeply enough, you think there's nothing changed. That's why it has an identity. We call it the Klang River. We think it's the same. That stream of consciousness which you observe, which was a real experience, many people have that. It was a real experience, but the whole process was changing every moment. It progressed. It was a process, not a thing. That's the only difference between, say, Hinduism and Buddhism. Yeah, we have this rebirth process, and it appears the same for most people. But as Buddhists with a powerful mind, superpower mind, because you can look in that, and you can see its particular nature. The other simile I gave yesterday was a simile of a beach. A stretch of sand looks continuous. But if you look upon it with greater detail, you find it's just particles of silica of sand with gaps between it. That whole experience, if you could look upon it with greater mindfulness, is it's one conscious moment with a gap and then another conscious moment, strung together just like the old movies. The silent movies, which you may even see these days, were just frames, still frames moving so fast you could not realize there were still frames. It gave the illusion of continuity of movement, similar to your experience.
So is that equivalent to a hallucination?
No, this is real, absolutely real. You weren't hallucinating, that was real. People have done this, they've done this experiments, like they've got their friends to get like a roulette wheel or something, and to twirl it above before you go to sleep so you can't see where that ball landed. Get you to actually in your astral body to go out there, see which number the ball has gone onto, and then check it out in the morning. And it's true, it's real. People have done that.
Thank you.
So it's real experience, not hallucination.
Ajahn,
yeah.
With science, we found that matter is actually composing of atoms, and matter is actually composed of atoms.
And matter.
Things form, actually are composed of atoms, and within these atoms, there is actually a lot of void, emptiness. So. Is it that when in samadhi, with this in the stage of samadhi, the person actually begins to see that nature of things, the common factor that links all forms or link all things in life, which is actually that emptiness, that void. So, an enlightened being actually is just, he has begun to uncondition his mind. He can see things from a different perspective. It's just like these 3D pictures that we have, which if we just see it like that, it's just a mess of pictures. Yeah, it's just like a graffiti. But if we look closer from a different perspective, a three-dimensional picture pops out. So, is it the same in terms of a concept?
It's interesting because I was a physicist before I was a monk. And one of the great parts of physics which really impressed me was quantum theory. And because quantum physics was one of the first parts of science where you needed a mind, it came out from the equations. And it wasn't just atoms with holes in it. In fact, atoms had no existence apart from an observer. For those of you who've done such science, you know that there was a scientist called Erwin Schrödinger. And now he's well known as the Schrödinger equation. It was the best, and when I was doing quantum physics, it was the best explanation for actually for sub-particle physics, such as atoms. What it actually showed that there's no such thing as an atom with a hole. It's just a spread of probability. It's like a smudge of matter which extends to every edge of the known universe. It's only more probable in some places than others. But until you make an observation, it's not meaningful to say an atom is located anywhere, or it has any extent, or any holes, or anything. It's a smudge of probability. And when you have an observation, when a mind gets involved, the term they use in science was it collapses the Schrödinger equation to give an observable event. But even that observable event is uncertain. The famous Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And that was actually meaningful because Schrödinger also gave his name to this wonderful thought experiment which became known as Schrödinger's cat. Now Schrödinger wasn't a Buddhist, he would not have thought of this if he was. The point of his thought experiment, he said, you can put a cat in a closed box. In that box was an ampule of cyanide. that cyanide would break if an atom would decay. The decay of atoms, a radioactive process, is a quantum process. He said you could arrange things so there's a 50-50 chance in 10 minutes that cyanide capsule would break and kill the cat. We said because it's a quantum process, the actual reality, which beggars belief, but it is true, the truth according to science, every experiment proves this is absolutely true. This is real, not hallucination. The truth is that until you open that box, the cat is not dead. The cat is not alive. Is in a third state. Now that doesn't make any sense, but it's true. What science taught me is that the way we look at the world is not the way the world is. The world is far more complex, far more adaptable. That's why quantum theory just stuns many people. They can't get a handle on it. The point is, their perceptual framework is too rigid. Cats are either alive or cats are dead. You can't have a third state. No, there's a third state there. So it's not true that atoms are full of holes. The world out there is not the important part. It's the perceiver in here. It's not what we perceive so much as who does the perceiving and how we do that perceiving. Delusion is not out there. Delusion is in you. So the reason why people don't become aligned, they're always out there. We're never actually in here. Who's doing the watching? Who asked that question? What asked the question? What collapses the probability spread of phenomena in the world to make this observable phenomena we call life? We actually literally, according to quantum physics, create the observable universe. We do, not God. That is solid quantum science.
Ajahn, then what is emptiness or void that you've been mentioning throughout this week?
The emptiness of you.
And what are these characteristics? Does it mean that it's just empty, a mess of empty space?
No.
Complete voidness?
It's interesting. This was actually said by the Buddha in the Kacchanagota Sutta. You cannot say there's nothing at all. The very fact you can ask that question shows there is something. He said the reason that because there's an arising of things in the world, you can't say there's absolute emptiness, there's nothing. Because there's a ceasing in the world, as soon as things arise, they pass away. You can't say there's something persisting. Emptiness is the emptiness of a self, of a knower and a doer. Knowing is, will is, but not the person who does the will, not the person who knows. Atoms are, life is, but it's in constant change, empty at its core of a being, a self, a God, or anything. That's where the emptiness is. Because it's wrong to say, everything is an illusion. Everything is emptiness. Because the fact you're here. You know, there's somebody inside. This is where philosophers, Christians, quite rightly sort of criticize absolute emptiness. I think it was a famous case that, I think it was Bishop Berkeley, an Irish philosopher, claimed he had this idealism that sort of everything is just in your mind. And it was George Bernard Shaw kicked him and said, I refute you thus. To be kicked is an experience. Experience is, as Krishnamurti said, life is, but it's not a person behind it. As I said the other day with Anatta, the path is, but no traveller on it is seen. Nibbana is, but not the person who enters it. It's the person is where emptiness lies, not in Nibbana.
Nibbana isn't empty. Understand?
No.
Okay. The emptiness of self, yeah. Very good. Thank you for being honest.
According to Abhidhamma teaching, the nimitta arises from the heart base. What happens if a person do not have a heart or an artificial heart?
Okay. I'm going to get into trouble here, but I'm going to say this again. The Buddha did not teach the Abhidhamma. I get into trouble there, but I say that and I quote the Vinaya Pitaka, the Chulawaga, I think it's chapter 11, where they give the account of the first council straight after the death of the Buddha, the Parinibbana of the Buddha, where the 500 monks met together to collect all of the teachings of the Buddha. That was their purpose, the first council. There it says specifically that Venerable Upali, the Arahat Upali, recited the Vinaya. Ananda recited the Pancha Nikaya, the five Nikayas, which everybody knows means the Digha Nikaya, the Majjhima Nikaya, the Sanyutta, Anguttara, and Kudaka Nikaya. There was no mention of Abhidhamma there at all. And as one of my heroes, Professor A.K. Warder, he was also at Cambridge University, he wrote this wonderful book called Indian Buddhism, specifically to use his knowledge and expertise of Sanskrit and Pali, and his knowledge especially of Pali Mita, actually the poems which were written as part of the Tripitaka, to find out what was the teaching of the Buddha and what came afterwards. What was original Buddhism and what was added? And he told her, he's not a Theravada, he's not a Mahayana, he was a scholar. He was like an umpire, a referee, not playing for any side. That's why I respect his argument. He gave a very strong, convincing argument. Basically because of all the different traditions of Buddhism, there's supposed to be 18 schools shortly after the time of the Buddha. Many of those schools survived. Their Vinaya is almost identical. There's a few changes. Their suttas are also almost identical. Their Abhidhamma is completely different. In fact, they split up mostly over disagreements on Abhidhamma. And his argument was this. He said what was common to all these schools is most likely to be original. What's different is more likely to be added. And even the language and concepts is different. That's why that I always go to the suttas and also to my experience. You don't need the Abhidhamma to become enlightened. The nimitta is not centered on the heart. The nimitta is the citta. It is a reflection of the mind. The heart is part of the body. Nimitta is part of the mind. It's a completely different area. So understanding that is, you understand what I said before. It is the body within the mind, not the mind in the body. So I refute that. I could get into trouble for that because some of the Mahatera is going to say, "Hey, Jambam, how can you say that? You're destroying Buddhism." But I don't care. Any other question? Interesting, for those about the Abhidhamma, there's a lovely sutta called the Gaudisana Sutta, somewhere around, where is that? Somewhere around 70-something in the Majjhima Nikaya, where it says that forest monks, it's about the forest monks. These are the monks who at the time of the Buddha would just live out in the jungles doing meditation. They said, a forest monk should learn and be an expert in Abhivinaya and Abhidhamma. It's one of the few cases in the Sutta Pitaka where they mention Abhidhamma. He said because the monks in the villages and in the cities expect forest monks
to know Abhidharma and Abhivinaya. Now to me, that's a dead giveaway that what Abhidharma was just deeper teachings of the Buddha, which you don't get from the books, which you get from your meditation. What I've been teaching here in the last 9 days is the real Abhidharma. The teachings you get from experience in deep meditation. That's what forest monks were supposed to know that. They wouldn't have read the books. There was no books there. The forest monks would have the Abhidharma, which one of the teachers of our tradition, Ajahn Mahabhua, kept on saying, Abhidharma is in here. In your deep meditation. Your own experience of the deeper Dhamma which you get from calming your mind, getting deep in meditation, getting superpower mindfulness, and uncovering truths which only you can see inside. That is the Abhidharma. The Abhivinaya, the Vinaya was the rules for the monks. These are the deep rules of restraint and simplicity which just come as a natural consequence of renunciation. Much more than just the precepts. But really, where those precepts are coming from. The deeper precepts, the deeper truth. You get into trouble, I know, but I'm already in enough trouble already, so who cares? Any other questions? Yeah, come on.
Hello, dear Achan. Yeah. I'm very fascinated by your explanation of physics. Actually, I want to clarify something. When you are talking about everything in this world actually perceived by the mind, are you talking about the time itself is actually part of our mind makeup as well?
Uh-huh, is it? Yes.
Because I studied a bit of physics, and then they start talking about the fourth dimension as the time and stuff like that. So, in this case, if it is true that we can control the fourth dimension, it should actually mean that we can actually go back time. So, can you clarify this? That if it's possible that our mind can be so strong and we can actually go back through time. Okay, that's the first question. The second question is, I must admit, I'm a coward. I'm afraid of ghosts and things that I'm unknown of. My imaginations, I think I read too much storybooks. It went wild and crazy. At night, am I sleeping alone? I can just think of the weirdest thing in the world that can happen to me. I tried before using meditation to steal my mind. It happened when I'm meditating. Then I stopped. And then I became very mindful of the things around me, like a wind blow, a thing ticks, and things were not happening. I would think like crazy, and I would just can't sleep, and I will have a very bad day the next day. So perhaps you can have any remedy for me. Thank you.
Okay. Actually, I'll answer the second question first about ghosts, because actually I should have done this earlier on. I've got to give a warning. Because you know, like as a monk, I know some of these things. There's a very dangerous ghost, not in this temple, your temple here is protected. There's an incredibly dangerous ghost around these days, especially in the West. And this is a ghost which actually does possess people very easily. I have seen many cases of this. And it's so dangerous, it actually kills people. It's true, many people have died because of this ghost. It gets into you, it possesses you, it actually makes you crazy. You do things you don't normally do, you say things in a strange voice, and sometimes it kills you. Its name is the bottle ghost. The bottle ghost, it lives in bottles of whiskey and beer. As soon as you open the bottle ghost, it takes possession of you. I've seen it, you've seen it. People speak in a strange way, they do strange things, they can't even walk in a straight line. They're possessed by the bottle ghost, and it can kill you. Why aren't people afraid of that one? Why else is it called spirits? Be afraid of spirits, the real ones. But people are not afraid of those, they're only afraid of the fake ones. I was always fascinated with ghosts, even as a young man. So when I was at Cambridge, I was a member of the Psychic Research Society. I joined it, and actually I became very friendly with the president of that society,
we've remained friends. The last time I was in England, it was actually for a temple opening of Ajahn Sumedho's monastery, Amarwati. And the day before the opening, I had lunch with his friend, who, I don't know if he was still the president, but he was one of the leaders. And even in those days, 30 years previously, he had this business card, which was obviously a conversation piece, because the business card said, it was Tony Cornell, BA or PhD or something, I think it was Dr. Tony Cornell, head of the Ghost Hunting Council of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. He was the head ghost hunter of the Psychic Research Society of London. And every now and again, someone would give me a Sunday paper in Australia. If there was any ghost happening in UK, he would be the one who investigated it and wrote the articles. He was the expert in England on ghosts, and he was a close friend. He still is. He said, when I went to see him, he said he was about to retire. And I talked to him a lot about ghosts, and he said one of the strangest things about ghosts. And he said he's been in many houses where things have been flying through the air. And he's not a gullible person, he's an academic. This was like his hobby, but it, what he became probably most known by. He said in all those cases, the thing flying through the air would never hit anybody. That was a strange thing. Ghosts can't harm you. They can only make you scared. That's as much as they can do. Strange, but that's been proved. All their research, the reports which they've done over 100 years in one of the most famous countries for ghosts, England, has proved you've got nothing to fear from ghosts except fear itself. And as a monk, I know that ghosts are certainly much more afraid of monks than you need to be of them. So, if you have a ghost, call the monks. We are the best ghostbusters. But even monks have to do it properly. So I remember giving a talk in Brickfields Temple alongside the Chief Venerable Kesari Dhammananda. We were exchanging ghost stories. Everyone was so happy to hear about ghosts. And he told me one case, there was a house close to Brickfields, which was haunted. They called in, I think it was a Christian family, they called in the Christians, then the Muslims, then the Hindus, then the Taoists, and eventually they got to the right person himself. He went in there, and it worked. After he did the chanting, the ghost left. The other religions, they couldn't dislodge the ghost at all. Unfortunately though, a few days later, after the ghost had disappeared from that house, all the neighbours came to complain because the chief had just managed to push the ghost next door. So he had to go in all the houses around doing the chanting to make sure the ghost didn't go to the neighbours, but really, you know, shoved off a long distance. So you don't have to be afraid of the ghosts. Now on the second question, or the first question which you said, about physics and time, I think you're really probably quoting Einstein, who just, you know, tried to actually to get the fourth dimension, the three physical dimensions, and time as a fourth. That was actually part of relativity. This is special relativity, not general relativity, which went a little bit differently. But I disagree with that, because under meditation you understand much more about what time is, and how time is much more part of the mind than part of space. The point is, though, it belongs to mind, not space. And here's what time really is. Time is created by craving. It's wanting creates the time. And you can experience that very easily. When you stop wanting, get very, very peaceful in a deep meditation, time no longer has any meaning. It's called the timeless present. For as soon as you want something, you can see yourself creating time. And it's why that some beings in the deep Deva realms
because of the lack of craving, their time gets dilated. It gets distorted. You read this in the sutras that sometimes one day for a deva is 100 years or 1,000 years for a human being. What's going on there? After deep meditation, you understand what's going on. It's because of the lack of desire that time stops. And even further than that, if you get into the jhana realms, here you survive the eons. You're so still, time stops for you. In those jhanas, you're just so still, so peaceful, so blissed, you've got no concept at all of time. Time disappears. You're going almost like into a different realm. And you can be meditating for hours or sometimes days. You're going almost like into a different realm. And you can be meditating for hours or sometimes days. You can't count the minutes at all. It means nothing to you. Time's been let go of. Which is why in those realms, if you pass off and get reborn in those realms, some of those realms last for thousands of eons. You're sitting there in bliss. A whole generations, planets, solar systems, universes come and go. You don't know a thing except bliss. That's the truth of things. I've already mentioned about the evidence about these guys going into deep meditation, not being able to feel their body, being sort of having electric shocks to try and get a heart going again. In these very deep states, even the cataclysmic beginning and end of the universe, you just don't know. They cannot affect you. Which is even why the Buddha actually was asked that question. Now, at the end of this universe, where do beings get reborn? And he said, beings, for the most part, get reborn in the realm of second jhana, while they wait for the new universe to begin, until there's a place where their stream of consciousness can find rebirth. You can understand why that's true. So, you create time. Next question.
Good evening, Achan Brahm. Welcome to Malaysia. I have two questions for you. And the first question is, how do you explain chakras from the Buddhist point of view? And the second question is, many Buddhists are practicing pranic healing, Reiki healing, and Ayurvedic healing. What is your advice? Thank you.
Okay, I'll answer the second question first, because I've already mentioned that about healing, Buddhist practicing healing. It's marvelous because it's your generosity, your act of dana to heal somebody else. And you do have that power. What I know is that the Reiki healing is not coming from some other being, it's coming from you. It's your energies. You may think it's coming from someone else, but it's your own energy, your own power of your mind. It's good to do. You have those powers. Use it. Whether it's Ayurvedic healing, whether it's homeopathy, I don't mind any pathies except psychopathy. So in other words, any healing is very good, and it's important that you actually help each other and care for each other and even heal yourself as well. So healing is good. Now the other question was, what was it again? Oh, chakras, yes. The word chakra is a Sanskrit word. The Pali word is chakra. I love chakras because you've got Dhamma chakra. That's my famous chakra. The wheel of the Dhamma. It was the first sutta of the Buddha was called the wheel of the Dhamma. And it's interesting that the Buddha actually looked at universes he called chakras, wheels. And for someone who didn't have access to a telescope, it was quite remarkable. The Buddha described the solar systems, not just the solar system, but the galaxies, in terms of wheels. That was a Pali word he used. If anyone knows anything about astronomy, the most common of galaxies is a spiral galaxy like ours, the Milky Way. If you saw that, you'd say that's a wheel. The other one is the globular clusters. They're more like balls, but they're not so common. And even solar systems, where the planets are in basically one plane, rotating about the sun, another wheel.
whenever I, because I was a scientist, and astrophysics and fundamental particle physics were the two parts I really loved. When I actually looked at the suttas as a young Buddhist, as a physicist, I was really struck just by how the two go together so seamlessly. In some religions, in Christianity, they just contradict each other. Science, physics and Christianity, they can't meet. The Bible says the world was created about 5,000 years ago. In Buddhism, there's one sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya. When I read that, he gave you a method of working out the age of the universe. As soon as I saw that, I did the calculation. It's not a hard one. And it came out to the age of the universe, according to that sutta, was 37,000 million years. An eon. When I got that answer, I smiled to myself, because according to modern astrophysics, we are so, at the moment, I think the latest calculation is about 13,000 million years since the Big Bang. In other words, 37,000 million years for the whole eon is a very reasonable estimate. If you tell that to a scientist, they'll say, now that's in the ballpark, that makes sense. It's incredible how the Buddha could know such things. It really is incredible. So the wisdom of a Buddha is huge in science. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. So again, I lost the question again. See? Chakras. Oh yeah, chakras. I'm just going into science again. So chakras, sometimes we call them energy spots in the body. There's nothing in the original suttas about those spots, but we can have many energy spots in the body. That's a Hindu concept. And about the idea of opening the chakras, I don't really know much about that. That hasn't been part of my spiritual practice at all. I don't think it's really necessary. I think the most important thing is actually understanding the mind and leaving the body alone. Those chakras are usually part of the body. And the mind is something much more powerful. And I like working with the mind. This body is pretty hopeless and useless. It is. I mean, just it's an old body. I'm only 53 years of age, but you already see it starting to fall apart and get sort of very, very weak. It's not going to get better, it's going to get worse. And that's why the best thing I can ever do is just to let the body disappear and just go into deep meditation, go into the realm of the mind. That's much more fundamental. You've had many bodies in the past. But your mind has continued on a process, not a self, a stream. And that's where the important things of life live, in your mind. You strengthen your mind. You make that very strong and powerful. And then you can really heal others, but importantly, you can heal yourself. And the best thing, the best healing you can give is the healing of suffering. That's why there was that story, I think it's a powerful teaching of Kisar Gotami. You all know that story, the Buddhists, you heard it in Dhamma school when you were kids, about a woman who lost her only son, died. She was so grief-stricken. I won't go into the details of the story, but the Buddha was asked to bring her son to life. And instead of bringing her son to life, using a trick, he taught Kisar Gotami Dhamma. To the point that Kisar Gotami didn't want to bring her son to life anymore. So what's the point? He'll only die again soon anyway. So she buried her son, became a nun, and soon became an arahat, fully enlightened. Interestingly, that you know how Kisar Gotami became enlightened? She was watching a flame and saw it blow out. Now do you understand that simile I said about Nibbana? She saw a flame Nibbana. And she saw that was her nature as well. For everything, her body, her mind, her doer, her knower, to cease in the same way. She saw the connection and understood it. And from that time she was an arahat. But the point of the story was, the Buddha was not so concerned to heal her body. It would only be a temporary fix. It was more important to heal her mind once and for all. So she didn't need a body anymore. So heal the mind. Look after the body, but it's not that important. Okay, any other questions?
Venerable Ajahn.
Oh yeah, absolutely. In the higher realms, yes.
I have a question to ask. I've heard from other monks, in particular Venerable Suvano, about the correlation between Christianity and Buddhism, where the Mahabrahma seems to correlate with God and Mara seems to correlate with the devil. Could you elaborate on this and also explain how does the Christian idea of the end of the world, Armageddon or apocalypse, whatever it is, correlates with Buddhism?
Okay. Okay. From the top there, again, you heard that question on the microphone. Mahabrahma is very similar to the idea of a Christian God, because there's one of the sutras there where one of the monks, I think I mentioned this the other day, he was wanted to find out where the four elements is without remainder. He went to one heaven realm, and they said, we don't know, go upstairs to the next heaven realm. He went all the way up to see Mahabrahma. And when he saw Mahabrahma, Mahabrahma actually said, I am the creator, the firstborn, the God, the Lord of all that is. It's nice to read that, because that sounds like the Christian idea of a God. And the monk said, look, I didn't ask that, who you were. I asked, where do the four elements cease without remainder? And God continued to say, I am God, the firstborn, the Lord of all that is, blah, 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 blah. Look, where do the four elements cease without remainder? Answer my question. And then he took the monk aside and said, now listen, I don't know, but these people have faith in me. So also, you're a stupid monk. Down where you came from, there's a Buddha. You should ask him. And so the God sent this monk down to see the Buddha to get the right answer. And it's interesting. I mentioned also, I think last night, about the Gnostic Gospels. In the Gnostic Gospels, I think it's in the Gospel of the Book of Thomas the Contender, I believe. It might be mistaken there. One of those books, I was reading that, I just laughed out loud when a very similar account appeared in these Gnostic Gospels found in Lower Egypt. God was in his heaven saying, I am the chief, the Lord, first creator, blah, blah, blah. And then he heard a voice, no, you're not. There are other beings higher than you who you simply don't know about. And God said, who said that? I don't know who said that. Who said that? And that's in the Gnostic Christian Gospels. That's fascinating. That's very Buddhist. It's almost like the delusion of the first one. Not the real God, but just the first being born in this eon who doesn't know more than that. It's in the Aganya Sutta, very well worth reading. And so maybe that might be your first answer. And I think what's the other one? Armageddon, okay. Instead of Buddhism, we don't believe in Armageddon. We believe in Karmageddon. The end of karma, enlightenment, nirvana. Because Karmageddon. So the point is that if you know the history of Christianity, the Armageddon was supposed to happen in the lifetime of the disciples of Jesus. Jesus specifically said, you will not have walked through all the towns of Israel before Armageddon happens. It was supposed to happen in a lifetime, it never did. At 1000 AD, everyone was predicting Armageddon would happen again. It never happened. In 2000, they were predicting again. It never happened. All the time they're predicting. I'll make a prediction. It will never happen. When, just before 2000, some of the Christians were actually going around. These are not the real Christians. The real Christians are great people. The real Muslims are great people. I have the utmost respect for real people like that. And many of my friends are Christians. Even some of the priests, the Benedictine monks, are great friends. The Dean of St. George's Cathedral in Perth is a great friend. So many friends are Christians. But these aren't what I sometimes call the crazy Christians, the evangelicals. But some years ago, just before 2000, the evangelicals were predicting the end of the world. And I was trying to find one to make a bet, a wager. I was going to bet them $1 million, Australian, US, you choose, that the world would not end. I want to make that wager, 1 million, that the world will not end. So if you really think it's going to end, put your money where your mouth is. They wouldn't do it. I was willing to do it, because if the world end, I wouldn't be around to pay, would I? If the world didn't end, I'd get $1 million for my retreat centre. It's a crazy idea. But why do so many people buy into that? Because people like fear. That's why it's a teaching which brings in lots of interested people, because people love to be afraid. And that's one of the reasons. But an intelligent, rational person would know that's, look at the history, that's been going on for so long, it's about time that people sensibly enough to look at their history books and don't worry about such things. That is not Christianity. Any other questions? Does that answer your questions?
Thank you, Ajahn. I hope we are not taking up too much of your time. I know it's over time.
Now remember that time is created by craving. If you want to go home, then time is important to you. If you want to go to bed, that's craving, that's time. So carry on.
My question is answered. Thank you.
Thank you. Very good. Any other questions? Yeah. Sorry, Dee. You might get tired, yes. It's a lot of projection of your own failings on me. No, it's very kind of you to have metta and have compassion. But are there any other questions? Yes, okay, come on. For those of you who are tired and need to go home, please you can leave. I will never be upset or offended.
Venerable sir, I wonder whether is it nimitta is really very important. If without nimitta, can a person be enlightenment?
Okay,
you ask. If I not understand wrongly, I hardly find is in the Nikaya, Buddha hardly mentioned about nimitta. Why?
Okay.
Thank you.
You're saying, is it really necessary to get nimittas, this stage of meditation just before jhanas, become enlightened? Yes, it is. If you know what you're looking for, you can find that very easily in the Nikayas. I think there's in the Anguttara, I think it says, I haven't got the reference in my head here, but I have it back in Perth, that without grasping the samadhi nimitta, you cannot get samadhiti, right view. Now that's what it says in the suttas. The samadhi nimitta, this nimitta, is again, I mentioned before, in anapanasati, it is the ninth stage of the anapanasati, chittang patisangvedi, to be able to feel, experience the jitta. Again, these are insights which you get from the experience. So once you have those experiences, in deep meditation, know exactly what this chitta means, why that is the ninth stage. You know, many years ago, I was thinking, look, where does the Buddha teach meditation in the suttas? Where is his like meditation manual? It's not the Satipatthana Sutta, it's Anapanasati. That's the meditation he used. And he got these 16 steps, which are absolutely brilliant. They need to be fully understood by someone who's experienced those 16 steps. And then you experience those things, you know exactly what the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th stages are. And you heard me say this before, the 9th stage is experiencing the nimitta. You've got a reflection of your mind. And that's why that the Buddha said that is the 3rd Satipatthana, Chittanusati. Calming the mind down, Samadhaṃ Chittaṃ, Abhipramojayaṃ Chittaṃ, that's brightening it up, giving it the brilliance. And many of you have heard me talk about this at length in this retreat. You get an nimitta up, stabilize it so it doesn't go off here and all over the place. Make it very bright and brilliant by being lots of joy and happiness in the meditation. Those are classic 9th, 10th, 11th stages of Anapanasati as the Buddha taught it. And the 12th stage, Vimocchayanchita, is the jhana itself. Sometimes that you can go past what's said in the Nikayas without experience. You don't understand. You don't see what the Buddha's talking about. But with experience, it all comes so alive. It's like you have this wonderful map of Paris. You don't really understand it, but you go to Paris. Oh, that's what, this big iron thing in the center of town. Oh, that's the Eiffel Tower. Oh, that's what it means. When you have the map and you have the experience, everything makes wonderful sense. That's why, just, I'm not sure if this is big controversy in sort of even the forest tradition of Thailand about the Prabhasarajitta, the radiant mind. And monks can have all these theories about what the radiant mind is. But it's quite clear when you actually get into nimittas, that is the radiant mind. Because when you experience a jitta, a nimitta, well, it's very powerful. So even many meditators of here said it's blinding. You come up to me and said you can't, the reason it disappears is because it's too strong, it's blinding. And if you were, had to call that something, what would you call it? You call it radiant nimitta. Pabhasara means intense radiance. The pa is an intensifier. Now you know Abha from Amitabha, unmeasured radiance. The Abha is radiance. Pa means intense radiance. Where does that tie in with your experience? Nimittas. It is. The trouble is though that sometimes we have a hard time getting the nimittas. So we think, please, Ajahn Brahm, tell me it's not necessary. It's like people in the West, when you sort of start to teach them Buddhism, they say, oh please, Ajahn Brahm, tell me the five precepts aren't necessary. They really want to get enlightened, but they don't want to actually pay the entrance fee. But I'm just being honest to you. It is necessary. Any other questions? Trouble is what happens, people go to other teachers. Oh, I haven't got the nimitta. You go to another teacher. Another teacher says, no, you don't need the nimitta. You say, right, I'll follow him. I don't mind. Any other questions? Going? No, okay. You can't go home, you know who to blame. Two ladies.
Please.
Okay, go on.
Because it's important about enlightenment. If a person handling money, can he or she be enlightened? Thank you.
If someone is handling money, can they be enlightened? Yes, they can. It depends how they're handling money, that's why. Because even as a monk, I can handle money. If the money is lost in the monastery, in other words, someone drops their purse or wallet, I have a responsibility to actually to pick that up and put it aside for the owner. That's part of my rules. But what you're saying is, can you possess, own your own money? Handle money yourself. And again, it's one of the rules, it's important rules. If you actually do it all the time, it's your money, you collect your money, you've got your own bank account, it's very unlikely. Because money is the means for greed. It's a means for actualizing your craving. So what do you need money for? I've been 30 years as a monk, haven't needed money. I go all over the world without any money. No one stops me. So I've proved you don't need money. What happens if you get sick? Look, you've got so many people. If I get sick, I don't even need health insurance. There's so many doctors and nurses here right now, they can't wait for me to get sick to make some more good karma. I'm not even sick yet, but people will be giving me all these herbal teas, vitamins, and all sorts of stuff. If I don't take them, please I apologize, because if I took them all, I'd be sick. I'm going to stop you now, because before we go, we should actually share merits. leave it out. Please chant along with me. Idang me nyati nang ho tu Sukhita-hontu-yata-yo Idam-men-yati-nang-ho-tu Sukhita-hontu-yata-yo Idam-men-yati-nang-ho-tu Sukhita-hontu-yata-yo Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, very good. Okay, have a nice night. See you next time. Good night.